On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The status quo certainly got stirred, if not shaken, this week. First woman Speaker of the House voted in, Nancy Pelosi. First black man memorialized on the National Mall, Martin Luther King Jr. Milton Friedman, dead, Jack Abramoff in jail. Clear Channel's media empire to be sold for $18 billion. Real tough hearings on Iraq. Sudan says yes, though we'll wait and see, to UN peacekeepers in Darfur. And American baseball pays $51 million just to talk to Japanese pitcher Daisuke Matsuzaka. That's new. But there's old, too, Iraq unsolved and scarier than ever. Trent Lott, back from exile, tornadoes on a tear. Up next on Point, we unpack the news of the week with keen-eyed reporters and you. We've got a great crew in today to look at the news. Joining us from Philadelphia is Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs correspondent for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
With us from Washington, Chuck Babington, congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. Chuck, plenty of news on your beat this week. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Trudy, and Chuck.
Chuck, let us go straight to you. All kinds of action on the Hill today. What's your top headline out of your beat?
The top headline out of my beat, Tom, is that Nancy Pelosi stepped on her big moment. She's the first woman to become Speaker of the House. The day that today should have been her big headlines in all the morning newspapers, and instead the headlines are about how she really lost on her first big effort, and that was to choose someone else to be the second-ranking position for the Democrats, Jack Murtha, over Steny Hoyer. She lost big time. And I think a lot of people, including fellow Democrats in the House, are just scratching their heads trying to figure out why she did this, what it means for the future. They really are puzzled about this this effort that she made, which was just a big disaster.
New York Times editorial today, Speaker Pelosi tempts disaster. What happened here, Chuck Babington? Give us the byplay. What was going on? What did Nancy Pelosi want? Why didn't John Murtha end up as her number two? How do you read this?
The byplay, Tom, is you need to go back at least 4 years, and that's when Steny Hoyer of Maryland made a bid for the top Democratic position at the time that was open, the whip job. And he lost to Nancy Pelosi, and he lost rather by a large margin.
Right.
And ever since then, at least all of Hoyer and all his people have said, you know, he read the results and he knew that he would not supplant Nancy Pelosi in the top job among the House Democrats. Pelosi never seemed to really get over. Even though she won, she always seemed to see him as a threat, and a lot of people thought that was not the correct read. But be that as it may, now that she becomes Speaker, or is about to become Speaker, instead of just accepting that Hoyer would remain in the second slot, she chose Jack Murtha, her longtime friend. He had been her campaign manager in the 2001 race. And then not just said, I prefer Murtha, but actively campaigned very hard for him. And what had happened over the years is that Hoyer has a lot of loyalty and a lot of friends in the caucus, and they were not going to abandon him, and they didn't abandon him despite Pelosi's efforts. And I think it was a miscalculation on her part. And so what you end up with is the very first thing that happens is she loses an important bid and undermines her own authority.
Steny Hoyer voted in 149-86 pretty persuasively as the majority leader under Nancy Pelosi, and they're all hugs and smiles on the front of the Times today. Jack, what do you make of this?
Well, you know, the first rule of politics is loyalty, and this is what this is all about. This, Murtha is her guy. He stood with her. She stood with him. I think that's what this comes down to. This will be forgotten in a week. I mean, same thing happened to Newt Gingrich in 1995. The person he put forward for majority leader, Walker, was voted down, and Tom DeLay was voted in. This happens all the time, but I really think this is this is a good example of what we always say about politicians, that they break their word. They're not well. She was loyal. She gave Murtha his chance. He didn't make it. And as for not being able to work with Steny Hoyer, she and Hoyer and the Democratic leadership in the Senate help engineer this takeover. So they work smoothly enough to do that.
Trudy, I want to get you on this, let's hear Steny Hoyer for just a second here, saying that he and John Murtha will play an important role in the next Congress.
We have had differences, Jack Murtha and I, but Jack Murtha will continue to be one of the most significant leaders in the Congress of the United States as chairman of the Defense Appropriation Committee.
Trudy Rubin, here we've got Nancy Pelosi, the first woman Speaker of the House. This is real history, and she's being watched especially closely then as to how she wields her power. How do you interpret this?
Well, something that struck me is that Nancy Pelosi has emphasized the anti-corruption issue, and we know that a lot of Republicans lost because that issue was big amongst their voters. There were so many corruption scandals amongst various Republican candidates. Now, Murtha has a problem in his past with an abscam scandal. He was never convicted of anything, but there's things that don't look good. Perceptions matter. So here,
the Times says he's got a quid pro quo addiction to moneyed lobbyists. Ouch.
Right. So Pelosi comes in, and for whatever reasons, loyalty, what have you, she pushes him. And also, Murtha did something very dramatic and I think bold in reopening the debate on Iraq. Mm-hmm. But he wants a withdrawal within 6 months. That's to the left of the Democratic spectrum. That also figures in it. Perceptions matter. Pelosi. But what I think is very interesting is this isn't the only fight that Pelosi is engaged in. There is an issue of a Congresswoman, Jane Harman, mm-hmm. who should have become the chairman of House Intelligence Committee. And Pelosi apparently doesn't want her as chairman and wants the number two, Elsie Hastings, who has a big corruption scandal in his background. He was impeached by the Senate as a judge, I think it was 89, and convicted by the Senate, although never convicted in a criminal court. Mm. But again, to be promoting at the very beginning leadership figures who have corruption scandals in their background doesn't look good. Harman is a very competent centrist. It makes it look like it's some kind of personal battle between them because Harman wasn't tough enough initially on the Iraq issue. And so I think Pelosi has to stand back and think about what she wants her image to be, because you can do a lot of damage at the beginning that lingers.
Trudy, Jack,
yeah,
please.
I was going to say, she's caught in the middle here. 44 members of the Blue Dog Democratic Coalition, conservative mm-hmm. Democrats, sent her a letter today saying you've got to put Jane Harman on, and 43 members of the Black Caucus sent her another letter saying you got to put Elsie Hastings.
what's a mother to do? Trudy, let's pivot on John Murtha. I'm sure we'll come back and look at politics, but Iraq has been huge this week as well. Lots of news from Iraq itself, from the UK and Tony Blair on Iraq, and hearings in the U.S. You've watched this so closely. What are the headlines grabbing your attention out of the Iraq debate?
I think the most fascinating thing was the hearings on the Hill with General Abizaid, the head of Central Command, who actually said this is the first time that a leading active-duty general has said it. He said that the U.S. did not have enough troops going into Iraq, and that General Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff, who had said we needed several hundred thousand and had been sharply rebuked by Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, that General Shinseki had been right, that it would have been much more effective. He actually said that phrase, General Shinseki was right.
Wow.
And, of course, President Bush has always said that the generals had never challenged the numbers, and Shinseki did challenge. And also, what Abizaid said was that it would be bad if a drawdown was begun over the next 6 months, that it would lead to more sectarian killing, and it would undercut any hope that this Iraqi government would ever get its act together. So this was quite dramatic. And there was very interesting interchange between Senator McCain and Abizaid. McCain said, do we need more troops? That's what McCain is pushing.
Right.
Abizaid said no. But then he qualified that. And what he said is, we might need more troops to put in more American trainers with Iraqi units. And I think that's going to be the key. I think that's going to be a recommendation coming out of this much-awaited Baker-Hamilton study group report on a new tactics or strategy for Iraq. More U.S. trainers, senior officers being put into Iraqi units to try to help them function better.
Talking about U.S. trainers while President Bush is in Vietnam, it boggles the mind. Let's listen to just a little bit of some of these exchanges General Abizaid faced on Capitol Hill. We've heard this, but there's a lot to listen to here. Here's Lindsey Graham, Republican South Carolina, pressing Abizaid on whether current troop levels are adequate. We hear first from General Abizaid.
Do we need more troops? And my answer is yes, we need more troops that are effective, that are Iraqi.
Do we need more American troops at the moment to quell the violence?
No, I do not believe that more American troops right now is the solution to the problem.
More troops, yes, but Iraqi troops, well, does that add up? Democratic Senator Jack Reed from Rhode Island asked Abizaid if time is running out in Iraq.
How much time do you think we have to bring down the level of violence in Baghdad before we reach some type of tipping point where it accelerates beyond the control of even the Iraqi government?
I think it needs to be brought down within the next several months.
90 days, 60 days.
4 to 6 months.
4 to 6 months, Chuck Babington, that is not much time. Senate and House hearings this week. What are you hearing in the aftermath? There did not appear to be any nice, clean, clear choices here.
There are not any clear choices. Obviously, if there were an easy choice, it would have been made a long time ago. And that's why the Democrats are as happy as they are about winning back the House and the Senate, largely because of the Iraq issue in the November 7 election, clearly don't know exactly what to do because there is no obvious answer, and they're sort of feeling their way along. Tom, one thing that really struck me is Senator McCain kind of being out there very lonely and still calling for more troops. Not only are virtually no one in the Congress backing him up on that, but even, General Abizaid. And I think give credit where credit's due. We often accuse politicians of not being particularly courageous, but I do think you've got to say that this is a fairly bold move by a man who clearly is running for president to be out there in an unpopular position of saying we need to send in more U.S. troops instead of withdrawing them.
Well, you call it courage, and maybe so, but Jack Beatty, maybe Senator McCain is looking at the sort of insolubility of this and saying, my gosh, I want to run for president as a Republican. My party got us into this horrible mess here. We'd better do everything right now to try and get out of it. I mean, is it courage or political calculation, Jeff?
I think both. I mean, the election really put him in a tough spot. The electorate wants no part of this war. People want out within a year, 18 months, something like that, 60-some percent. So he's got the wrong position there. And he knows it. And so the question is, let's get this over with as quickly as possible. In fact, he has even said that. He said, either we reinforce and save the day there, or we get out, because what we're doing now isn't going to work. And I think that calculation is part of it. But, just to back up again, he had an exchange with, later in the afternoon, the CIA director and the DIA director gave testimony. And he put to them a question he had put to Abizaid, and he said, "Do you find it strange, generals, that do you think it's a good thing that the Iraqi government told us not to blockade Sadr City? We were searching for people who had kidnapped an American soldier,
yeah.
Because that was upsetting their political calculations, and so we did that. Do you think that was a good idea?" And they said, well, no, they didn't think it was a good idea. Earlier, Abizaid had spun that around and said, that shows how autonomous this government is. And suddenly it occurred to me, the Shiite government, I think, is using us as a shield. They are using us to fight the insurgency in Anbar and elsewhere. And meanwhile, they are, when we try to go into the Shiite areas, they call us off, and I'm afraid we're being played there, and I think that the Abizaid spin really gave the game away. It seems to me.
Who's playing whom? The big question here, Trudy Rubin. I mean, this was a week when to me it began to seem as though the scales were falling away from our eyes on just how costly and tough this war is going to be to extricate the country from, the costs that may accumulate to this nation that may eventually come into many more families and households and be much more real than just go shopping here. I mean, it looks like a long-term hellish situation that's going to get a lot closer to our throats than it has felt.
It is a long-term hellish situation, and I think the reason you see so much back and forth and tension on the Hill is because everybody knows there is no good way out. In a way, John McCain is right, because what is happening now is we are playing whack-a-mole. I happen to believe from a lot of experience in Iraq that the real problem is Sunnis, not Shiites, because the Shiite militias are disliked by a lot of Shiites, but none of them will stand up against those militias so long as hardcore Sunni insurgents who are Baathists or ultra-religious fanatics are blowing up Shiites. And for a long time, Shiites turned the other cheek. Last February, one of their holiest shrines was pulled out. Now there's revenge seeking. So what happens is we send troops in with Iraqis. We clean out some area of the Sunni heartland. And then we don't have enough troops. We pull them back to Baghdad.
But are there enough troops?
And come right back again.
But are there enough troops in the world, Trudy, to do this? I mean, Americans asking themselves, do we go in and fix it, or is it unfixable? The British left after years and years without having solved it.
Right. And the British lived in another era where Iraq was in a backwater of a far-off region. I think the quandary that nobody has been able to answer is this. We pull out. The civil war starts in earnest. Well, if one side would win, sometimes that's the way civil wars end.
Sometimes.
What I believe is that neither side will win. And so what you have is a country in total collapse, not with three neat federal states, but with fighting, infighting. And the big problem for us is that the Sunni part of that territory will become a no man's land, I believe, a mini Taliban land, Afghanistan circa 1998, where outsiders will come in to train, not to come to Brooklyn, but to fan out and try to undermine other regimes in the Middle East. And the other big fear that people have is if you have this ongoing civil war, the civil war in Lebanon, after all, lasted for 15 years, that Shiite Iran and the Sunni Arab neighbors of Iraq will feel compelled to come in. So you'll have upheaval in the whole region, affecting oil prices, affecting the terrorist issue, and we'll be outside where we have to go in again. You know, this is the conundrum that no one can answer.
It's god-awful, and I'm not a huge one for looking back, but when you see what we're stuck in here, some accountability for who got us into this and was this wise or absolute insanity. I don't know. That question's on the table. I want to turn to our listeners. Joseph,
can I just mention Trudy, one thing on that question? I will never forget an interview that I did with Paul Wolfowitz in November 2002, in which he told me he would be astonished if there were instability after a war, and that the correct historic analogy for post-war Iraq would be post-liberation France.
Yeah, well, we've got dead kids here, and all of our kids' futures on the line in the aftermath. Joseph is calling from North Augusta, South Carolina. Hi, Joseph. You're on the air.
Hi, I have a quick comment and question about Iraqi's government. Ahmed Chalabi, he is the minister of oil over in Iraq.
Was.
He was? He's no longer?
I don't believe he is now.
No, he's not.
Okay,
he has no position in the current government.
Okay, well, my question is, in the run-up to the war, he was the head of the Iraqi National Congress that was paid millions of dollars of American taxpayer money, and they provided false information to get us into this war.
So where do we go with that, Joseph?
Well, my question is how he got that position, and now that the Democrats are in charge, is there going to be any investigation on how the oil was run by him and running it, and how they're running it now?
Let us pick it up. Chuck Babington, what about looking back, investigations, inquiries? Are we going to see this, or is the problem in Iraq so big it's all forward and hang on?
I think you're going to see some of it, Tom, and I think that's one of the big decisions that Democrats in the House and the Senate have got to make in the next few weeks, is how much to focus their hearings and oversight once they get in charge of all the committees on looking back at the, you know, the pre-war use of pre-war intelligence, the contracting in Iraq, that sort of thing, and how much to look forward. They know if they do too much backward looking, they're going to be seen as looking for recriminations and revenge and that sort of thing. And yet, a lot of their constituents and people who voted them into office last week are saying, you know, this is exactly what Congress should have been doing all along, and we have to hold the administration accountable. So I think they're going to look for a little of both, backwards and forward-looking, but it's, obviously they're going to be back in charge of these committees after 12 years out, and it'll be very interesting to see how they use them.
A lot of other news this week, but let's pull the prism back on this one just a little bit before we turn away. Tony Blair on Monday, speaking in London, saying the only way to fix Iraq now is to pursue a broader whole region policy.
A whole region policy should start with Israel-Palestine. That is the core. We should then make progress on Lebanon. We should unite all moderate Arab and Muslim voices behind a push for peace in those countries, but also in Iraq.
Solve the whole thing. Kareem is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Kareem, you're on the air.
Great segue into what I was going to say. A former American president, Jimmy Carter, released a book a couple days ago on the very topic that Blair started off that little snippet with. And it's been buried. I haven't seen it anywhere.
What's the book?
Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
Oh, Jimmy Carter ringing a bell there. And what's his point in the book, Kareem?
Well, that maybe the Israeli state has more than a few parallels to apartheid South Africa and racist subjugation of Palestinian population. Therefore, you don't see it or hear of it.
Do you think Iraq and Israel and the Palestinians are connected, or is that too broad a canvas?
Of course, Tom, of course. As long as London, Washington, Tel Aviv think it's okay to go in and subjugate and manipulate the capitals of Baghdad, Damascus, wherever, we're going to have this issue.
Trudy Rubin, pick this up. There has been very tough fighting over the last couple of weeks. Israelis, of course, going into Gaza, and Hamas stepping up with more power there now. Here's Tony Blair saying we've got to have a whole region-wide solution. Former Secretary of State James Baker suggesting he may put forward something like that as well. Yeah, I mean, Iraq looks big enough to chew off. Are these all connected? Do you have to solve them all to solve any part?
You know, I think the sad thing is that the Bush administration totally dropped the Israel-Palestinian issue over the last 6 years. Bush talked about a two-state solution, but basically the administration did very little. They left the initiative totally up to the Israeli government because they were focused on other things, and it was not a priority despite the fine language. I think at this point right now, it's very difficult to make a huge push on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, because they are so meshed in big immediate problems in Iraq. But I do think it will work its way back to that. When you talk about a regional approach, what Blair was discussing in part was the need to deal with Syria and Iran. And also Baker has said that it's not wrong to talk to your enemies. I think you will see an effort to bring Syria and Iran into talks on stabilizing Iraq. And then through that back door, one might possibly get back to Syrian-Israeli peace talks. I think it would be useful for the administration to focus more on Israel and the Palestinians. It'll be very difficult to have any kind of major initiative now at a time when everything else is falling apart for this administration in the region.
Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, of course, in Washington, met with President Bush on Monday. He was warning of the consequences of a nuclear Iran.
If Iran achieves the ability to produce nuclear weapons, as we know it is seeking to do, we will enter a new era of instability unlike any the world has ever seen.
And the world has seen some pretty big eras of instability. Chuck Babington, what about it? Appetite on Capitol Hill for taking on the whole smorgasbord here? If James Baker says you've got to solve Israel and the Palestinians' problem to solve Iraq and Iran's part of it too, Have they got the I don't know, the bandwidth for that?
That's a great question. I think if James Baker and Lee Hamilton and the rest of their study group comes out with that recommendation, it certainly will have a very serious look, because the truth is that Democrats and Republicans alike in Congress are desperate for some solution, or at least some type of something to cling to, something to grab to and say maybe this is the best way to go. And that's why I think there'll be a lot of bipartisan, at least initial, if not support, certain to take very seriously what this group comes up with. You know, that said, definitely what drove the election last week was Iraq, much more so than anything else. And that is what's foremost in the minds of the the members of Congress. Obviously, the Israeli-Palestinian situation is always very important, but Iraq is really the big front burner issue before Congress, and that's what they're trying to cope with one way or another.
But a lot in play here. Also, yes, it's Trudy.
What I was going to say is what Olmert and the Israeli government are implying is that if diplomacy won't work with Iran, something more might be needed to keep them from getting a nuclear weapon. And I think what is becoming clear is the United States needs Iran's help on Iraq. And the military option in trying to end Iran's nuclear program, a nuclear energy program, which people think is aimed towards producing at least the capacity for a weapon, a military option looks more and more unlikely, first, because it wouldn't destroy the program, second, because it would make a state of war between us, Israel, and Iran, and with a country that would still have a program because it's underground and nobody thinks that bombing would stop it. So I think what you're seeing here is, even as Israel is trying to get the U.S. to take a tougher position against Iran, there is all this talk about trying to bring Iran into talks on Iraq. So again, the Iraqi situation is driving everything in the region.
Abramoff and Trent Lott, two names in the news this week. On Wednesday, Republicans chose Trent Lott as Minority Whip. John Boehner, of course, riding high there today. When Trent Lott's name came back, Chuck Hagel, Republican, Nebraska, said, "In America, everyone deserves a second chance.
Everyone has an opportunity to rehabilitate themselves if they want to do it. And I admire Trent Lott for coming back and offering himself. The conference spoke, and we go forward."
Okay, there we go. Chuck Babington, never mind Nancy Pelosi for a minute. Trent Lott back? What are the Republicans thinking here?
Well, just to remind our listeners, it was 4 years ago that he attended a 100th birthday party for Strom Thurmond, and in his remarks, off-the-cuff remarks, he said that the country would have been better off if Thurmond had won the 1948 presidential election. Well, that election was Thurmond was a Dixiecrat running on a segregationist platform, and the hue and cry that emanated from that, you know, drove him from the leadership position, and it's taken him 4 years to kind of claw his way back. You know, what's really going on here, Tom, is that the Senate Republicans, more so than the House Republicans, are really shocked at the election's results. They did not think that they would be in the minority, and now it's they're looking internally to how do we organize ourselves? Who do we turn to for help? And in this case, they wanted to turn to kind of an old veteran insider who really understands the House and the Senate, who can work across the aisle with Democrats, and they chose Trent Lott by only one vote, mind you, but over Lamar Alexander, who's been in the Senate only 4 years.
So his infighting skills look worth the mud and reputation problems?
Absolutely. I talked with several Republican senators about this, and to a person, that's exactly what they said. They said, look, 4 years is a long time. You know, he's paid his dues. He's apologized over and over. We can move forward, and we really need his skills at this time.
And then, Jack Beatty, we've got Jack Abramoff now sitting in jail. Does that slam the door on an era or not?
I don't think it does. I think that they're going to be he's very close. He's either going to be in Maryland or in West Virginia. He's very close to the FBI, and they're going to continue to be mining him for information. ABC had a report the other night that there was going to be something about Harry Reid coming out. Big denial from everybody, and in fact, people close to Abramoff said he didn't know any Democratic senators. We don't know about that, but perhaps other Republicans too. But Abramoff, you know, the election really was about partly that too, corruption, and not just the corruption in the Abramoff way. You know, the golf tour, the tickets to the basketball game, the calls to the White House. Not just that, but also the other stuff, the worst stuff. The legal stuff, the bribery by campaign contributions, that remains the besetting problem. It's that shaped these bills that from energy to prescription drugs and on that have you know helped to bankrupt the Treasury and haven't really and aren't really effective as public programs because they're designed really to put public funds in private hands. And that connection between the drug industry pays, the drug industry gets, that's the thing that's the structural impediment that stands in the way of really political equality in this country. And we can't have anything approaching that without substantial public financing of our campaigns.
Trudy Rubin, we've got all kinds of stuff going on here, not just on Capitol, outside Delta and U.S. Air up in the air with maybe U.S. Air coming after Delta. What do you make of that?
The first thing that I thought of when I heard it is that U.S. Air has been struggling for the past few months to remedy a situation in Philadelphia, which is one of their major hubs, where Philadelphia has a reputation as the worst, I think, in the country for baggage handling. Baggage is lost at an astonishing rate. And I kept thinking, if U.S. Air and Delta merge, what's going to happen to the baggage handling?
please. Help us here.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be rerouted to Tehran. Then we'll have to have relations to get our bags back. But, you know, it's really fascinating because U.S. Air, you know, just came out of bankruptcy not long ago, and it's merged with Air West, and that merger hasn't even there are still bits and pieces of it that haven't fully been finalized. And so it really takes a lot of moxie. They are bidding for a carrier that's still in bankruptcy. I think Delta is the fourth largest, U.S. Air the fifth largest carrier. And I also kept thinking that would be taking on huge debt levels. So, you know, I'm. But what it does show is that the post-911 impact on airlines in this country still hasn't been played out. Because airlines are still struggling, and probably there are going to be more mergers.
More mergers. If Congress is on board with that, if the public, well, who knows what kind of fares we're going to have if everybody starts consolidating there and they just start that off.
Yes, one might ask.
Joshua is calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Joshua. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just want to make a three-pronged proposal for the new Speaker of the House. First of all, in the way to move forward in Iraq, the road to peace in Iraq involves accountability of the present Congress. There was a time in this country when it was unpatriotic to oppose the war in Iraq. People have to investigate the failures that led to this quagmire in Iraq through the U.S. Congress. It's not just the Bush administration that is at fault here, but the Congress that approved and sanctioned this quagmire in Iraq.
So you want all history on the table. What about at home, Joshua?
Yeah. The second issue is, of course, the way forward at home has to involve economic security for the American middle class. I mean, the American middle class is taking the brunt of this war. I mean, people can't go to schools in this country. Infrastructure is falling apart. And there are so many other issues that has to be dealt with. So we can't, the two are actually intertwined. Accountability of the Congress is intertwined with economic security and homeland security in this present country.
Chuck, those Joshua, those are two big ones right there. Let us pick it up. Chuck Babington, what about the mood on the Hill? Do you feel a fresh day dawning here, like people out with shovels ready to dig in a new way? Or is everybody hunkering down looking at 08? What's it look like?
Joshua, I think, articulated very well the argument for accountability, and that is, I think, a lot of Democrats feel that that was part of the mandate from last week's elections. And he made a good point. It's not just the administration that should be looked at, but Congress itself. Now, it'll be interesting to see how much they turn the spotlight on themselves. Obviously, it would be the Republican-controlled former Congress that they were looking at. But, you know, my colleague Tom Ricks, in his very good book about the war fiasco, his chapter about the Congress was titled Silence of the Lambs, and it's a pretty apt description. So there is a feeling that now's the time to begin investigating and questioning what happened. I guess what's dampening spirits all around, though, is the feeling that as you do look forward, there is no obvious solution of a way out.
And, of course, at the same time, all the questions around the economy, who's making what, a big deal with Clear Channel, of course, out there, $18.7 billion in private equity headed there. People looking on and saying, how does that affect me, Joe Worker? Big news today, Nobel Prize-winning economist dying yesterday at age 94, one of the most influential economic voices of the last century, fierce proponent of less government and more individual responsibility. He was here on the show in January 2005. I asked him if Americans, after the New Deal and the creation in the following decades of strong government support systems, still had the character to embrace his free market universe.
They sure do. Look at what happened during the Internet period, during the 1990s, and look at what's happening now in various areas. If you leave people alone, they'll do pretty well by themselves. they don't need to have somebody in Washington telling them what's right or what's wrong.
You say that, and yet, as you point out yourself, Milton Friedman, the government spending has not gone down. It's held steady, but it hasn't gone down as a portion of the nation's income. Isn't that a kind of indicator that Americans are reaching out for those things that government's providing?
Well, of course, everybody wants to get... The key thing about people is that they want to live at somebody else's expense. And a government is a system, a welfare state is a system where everybody can live at everybody else's expense. So the truth of the matter is that a really free society is a rare event, and it's a miracle when it does happen.
A giant of 20th century economics, they're speaking with us in the 21st century, and of course, a debate around all that still swirling. Very relevant stuff here. John McCain yesterday saying the Republicans need to come home to their simple conservative agenda of smaller government. Milton Friedman, the big champion there. Jack Beatty, your thoughts on the passing of Milton Friedman?
Well, I'm not competent to render any economic judgment about him, but I did read his great book, and I say that truly just as an amateur, on the monetary history of the United States. What's fascinating there is his appetite for heterodox positions. For example, in the 19th century, he finds himself in agreement with William Jennings Bryan and the populists that we should have got off the gold standard and gone to silver. I couldn't believe that, but he shows why they were right. He has got qualifications, but basically that's what he says. And you know, what people are saying about him now is his prescience. How, as an economist in the 60s, and I well remember this, when Keynesianism, you know, pump priming, adjusting a little bit here, adjusting a little bit there, managing the economy. When that was regnant, he said, "Oh boy, this pump priming, this putting of money into the economy to get unemployment down, to keep the economic growth up. This is going to mount up, and you're going to have stagflation. Mm. You're going to what Paul Samuelson calls stagflation. You're going to have rising unemployment and rising inflation simultaneously." And he called it right. That's what happened in the 70s, and for the reason he said. His solution to that was you fight inflation, and really the only tool government should have to deal with the macroeconomy is monetary policy. You set targets for the money supply, and you keep to them, and Paul Volcker implemented that to fight inflation. Of course, we had 18% interest rates as a result, but inflation was squeezed out of the economy. That was an immense achievement. And I think, theoretically, he deserves a lot of credit for that.
Trudy,
what struck me on hearing about his death and reading his obit is that Friedman became a guru for economists in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe who were closet liberals, who worked for government economic institutes, couldn't speak openly about this. Mm. And when the Soviet Union came apart, Friedman-esque economics was tried with U.S. encouragement, also initially in Poland. And what you see is that Friedman stood at the far end of a spectrum. He didn't even believe in public schools or licensing for professionals like doctors. Government should stay totally out. But in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, it was very hard for publics who had been under a totally state-controlled system to adapt. And basically, total free market economics failed because the public rejected it, because ordinary people couldn't cope with it. They suffered terribly. And a few smart people, sharpies, managed to get their hold on natural resources, especially in the former Soviet Union in Russia, and become gazillionaires. And so actually free market economics got a bad name in Russia. Mm-hmm. So it's like one entire swing of the pendulum. And what he stood for was, you know, marking out that certain space. But I think it's very hard to implement in practice. And in fact, when the Bush administration came into Iraq, they had illusions about privatizing everything right away, the oil industry, ministries. Mm. And then what they realized is you had a system where everyone depended on the state and you couldn't just drop them in the pond overnight. And so U.S. officials had to back off. And it's still a totally statist system, which is very bad also. So I think Friedman defines a far line, and the reality that you can achieve or want to achieve is somewhere much more in the middle.
Chuck Babington, bring that line home for us. I mean, it used to be a kind of a fairly straightforward debate, big government, small government. Now we've had big government Republicans for a number of years. John McCain saying, let's go back to the old faith. You've got Democrats in power, but a lot of blue dog Democrats and the Clinton strand of Democrats in the middle there. How do you see the Friedman kind of long debate over government role playing out in politics going forward in this country?
One of the great debates that we're going to see, at least in the next 2 years, especially in the Republican Party, is over spending and deficits. Obviously, we all know that under the Bush administration and the Republican-controlled Congress is there have been tax cuts and there's been spending increases. And so, of course, the deficit has gone very high. And there are some you're starting to hear a little bit, you know, that old name of deficit hawks. Remember them? We used to hear about them. And they are especially active in certain segments of the Republican Party. They're very angry about what's happened. They say that the party has lost its moral compass, and it's going to be a great infighting within that party that at least in the congressional level, is on the outs now of whether they should go back to that, and which, of course, means hard decisions that the public would prefer not to make, either tax increases or spending cuts or some combination thereof. Mm-hmm. And, of course, now with the Democrats in charge, there's also going to be an onus on them. Are they going to let the deficit continue climbing, or are they willing to make the hard decisions?
Old debates sometimes float away. And history, Bush in Vietnam, and no one's really paying any attention at all. The headlines, though, out of this deal with the Japanese pitcher, Jack, Daisuke Matsuzaka, $51 million paid just to talk to this pitcher about bringing him over to the USA. Wow, this is new.
It is. And I couldn't even go on to read the story because, you know, what's happening in baseball, professional sports in general, is that middle-class people can't even go to these games anymore. You're talking about, take a kid, take his friend, you're talking about $100 for an afternoon. Throw in the parking. You know, and each with each big salary, with each, you know, throw out of money to the team to get this player and other players, up goes those ticket prices, and more this becomes an elite pursuit.
Trudy, going to just have platinum-plated Japanese pitchers and the rich sitting in American baseball stadiums?
Yeah, I had a vision of Fenway surrounded by a million sushi bars.
Okay, we've got wild dreams going on. Chuck, are you up for that? Would you like extra wasabi with your baseball?
Let me tell you, Jack said it for me. I love sports. I played sports. They priced me out of the market years ago. I'm truly astonished that people will pay the prices for the tickets and the parking and the beer. I just don't see how they do it. It's amazing to me.
Well, here's to the game. Long may it rain and everybody be able to watch it. Chuck Babington with The Washington Post. Great to have you with us today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Trudy Rubin at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, always great to have you. Thanks for joining us at the end of this big week. And Jack Beattie, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.